Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the appeal of magic? Why do we thrill to illusions even when we know intellectually that the performer is putting something over on us? Alex Stone developed a passion for magic as a kid when it served as an ideal path to bonding with his dad and a perfect creative outlet for a bright but nerdy kid. It was a devastating performance, though, at a magic competition in his early adulthood that motivated Stone to study magic with as much zeal as any academic subject. And in the process, he was able to bring his knowledge of psychology, math, and even physics into the equation. Alex Stone has written for publications including The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, Discover, and Harper's. His book, Fooling Houdini, Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind, is available now in paperback. Alex, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks.
You say there are two kinds of people in the world, magicians and lay people. For a magician, what is the difference?
Right. Well, it's definitely, this is how magicians think and talk about it. There are people who do magic, and then there's everyone else. Mm-hmm. And they refer to them, you know, almost like the clergy used to, as the laity, and there's the ordained. And, you know, even when they talk about tricks, for example, you know, they'll say, oh, this is a great layman trick. You know, this is a trick that will fool laymen, but not magicians. And then if they have a special trick, they'll say, this is a magician fooler. You know, and it's just funny how it's like there's this sort of tacit assumption that you're either in or you're out.
Yeah, it's cool that you discovered that magic gave you an entree into this world where it was okay to be a little nerdy, a little weird,
required, I think.
But once you're part of it, I mean, your experience was people are surprisingly generous with sharing what they have learned.
Yeah, that's right. I think there's this perception that it's this impenetrable cabal no one from the outside can join. But there's a whole spectrum. There are certainly some people that are, you know, a vault when it comes to sharing their material and their secrets. But there's also a lot of people, I'd say by far the majority, who are really very willing to impart advice and help you out. If I would say, you show an earnest desire to learn and to be part of, you know, the community or, you know, that you're not just looking to know, you know, to figure out how it's done. There's a lot of quid pro quo. You know, you learn something and then you share it with someone else and then they share something with you in return. But it is in a way a very kind of generous world and more welcoming than I think a lot of people probably think.
And is there a lot of intergenerational communication?
Yeah, that's right. There's definitely a tradition of mentorship in the magic world. I mean, often you'll hear magicians, you know, identified in a kind of like, almost like Game of Thrones or like Iliad. You know, Tamariz, whose master was Ascanio, the great Spanish founder of the Madrid school, which I think is just really fun. But it's true. I mean, there's, you know, because in many ways magic, at least for many years before the internet and stuff, it was kind of an oral tradition. A lot of the secrets were passed on, directly between people. So that's right. There's this kind of, you know, sense of mentorship and schools almost of magic and passing on information and the secrets from one generation to the next.
So you're 5 years old. Your dad comes home and says, Alex, I have a present for you. And he gives you this magic kit. What did it represent to you at the time? What did that magic set that your dad bought for you when you were five, what did it represent to you?
Oh, yeah. You know, it was he was on a trip to New York, and I think it was an FAO Swartz kit that he bought me. And I just remember being so thrilled by it. I think a lot of kids probably got a magic kit when they were young, but for some reason, it really stuck. And I remember for my dad was a scientist, and, you know, he's a man of science. He's always been a skeptic, an atheist, someone who's been, you know, devoted his life to the pursuit of knowledge. And I remember when I started showing him the tricks, he got very excited and he was very happy. And he also, one of the curious things about it was he never wanted to know how the tricks were done. Even to this day, I'll show him a trick and I'll say, oh, I really want to explain to you how it's done. It's based on this really cool principle. And he'll plug up his ears and say, no, I don't want to know. And I thought that was really interesting. He likes the mystery of it. And it was definitely a way in which we bonded. You know, we'd go to, like, my birthday treat, we'd go to the magic store, and I'd get, you know, to pull all the money that I wanted on, you know, whatever, some new trick. And it was really fun because they at magic stores, typically they demonstrate the tricks for you, so you get, like, a little show in the process. And I don't know, you know, he never really did sports. He wasn't religious. That was kind of one of the things that we bonded over. So it was both, like, a way of being a nerdy, geeky kid and having a hobby that was fun, and also kind of a way for my dad and I to chill together.
Well, what's so interesting about your dad's response is that it gets to a question that is in some ways at the heart of the book, which is why all of us, so I should say many people, really love magic, even though, you know, maybe 100 years ago people believed there might be actual magic. Now everybody kind of knows it's an illusion.
I don't know if I'd agree with you there. I think 60% of Americans believe in angels. More than a half of people in America believe in paranormal interventions. A lot of people still believe in magic. I mean, religion is a kind of magic, right?
So do you think when people go to a big magic show somewhere that they actually think that, you know, your childhood idol, David Copperfield, has
floating in midair? No, you're absolutely right about that. People don't typically go to a magic show and believe that it's real, although I will say that a lot of people in England or believe that Derek Brown is actually doing a lot of things that are really he's not doing, or David Blaine even crosses that line. That's right. I mean, when it's presented as sort of entertainment in Vegas, everyone knows that there's a trick. But there's still a lot of things that are technically within the branch of magic. Here, I'd say things like psychics and mentalists and, you know, and also ultimately, you know, a lot of religious beliefs, I think are closely aligned to magic and are essentially a form of magical thinking. But yeah, you're absolutely right. No one really thinks that David Copperfield is a sorcerer, and if they do, then they need help.
Is it your sense that magicians, even before psychology was like an official academic discipline, do you think magicians have always intuitively understood that they needed to know how their audiences were thinking in order to pull these tricks off?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think magicians have for centuries, or probably since the beginning of the craft, had an intuition for how people see things and how people behave and human psychology. And it's really, I think, that's kind of the thing that I like the most about it, is the way it's just window into perception and how people think and see things. And it's interesting now that scientists in the last, you know, 30 years, if you look at the literature in psychology on attention and perception and cognitive biases, a lot of this stuff is essentially co-opting the principles of magic and some of their techniques even, and, you know, transporting them into a laboratory setting to study human behavior. So it's kind of neat that scientists have now glommed onto this idea of using these techniques to try to model experimentally what magicians for centuries have understood somewhat.
Yeah, I love this sentence. You write that at its core, magic is about toying with the limits of perception. And it's true that, you know, I guess magic works because we believe our eyes, even though we can't always see, we can't always, you know, we know that we are being fooled by something. My guest is Alex Stone. I think we are about to get him back on the line here. If you want to be part of the conversation today about his new book, Fooling Houdini, Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind, you can join us at 1-800-933-5372. I'm going to repeat that question for you, Alex, because I think we lost you halfway in it. You write that magic is about toying with the limits of perception. And it essentially, it works because we believe our eyes even when our eyes are deceiving us.
Yeah, that's right. It's very strange. There's all these, the human brain is surprisingly easy to fool because we have all these little wormholes in our brains, gaps in our perception. You know, the way optical illusions can fool you, for instance. I wouldn't say it's the eyes so much. Our eyes are actually a remarkably efficient and accurate tool. We can detect motion on the order of a hundredth of a second. Five photons or particles of light are sufficient to trigger a conscious visual response. It's really the brain that's messing up. It's, for instance, the way we pay attention or focus on a singular task while ignoring, you know, ancillary distractions is great, you know, in one sense because it allows us to accomplish things. But it also, the flip side of that is that, we ignore and sometimes are blind to things that are going on around us, sometimes right even in front of our eyes if we're not focused on them, if we're focused on something else. And also that our memories are very fallible, and the way we perceive changes and scenes, we found out that those are very much subject to distortion. And so we magicians exploit this, and by doing so, they really show us how easy the brain is to trick. And that's kind of neat, because it tells us a lot about what it means to be human and fallible.
So what you specialize in is like close-up magic, right? Things, card tricks and things that you do with your hands that people could be 5 feet away from you and observe the whole thing.
Yeah, so typically there's two big branches of magic. There's the stage magic, the illusion that take place. That's the David Copperfield type stuff, the stuff you see in Vegas. And then there's the close-up and sleight-of-hand magic, and that's the stuff that's done usually with cards and coins. And like you said, it's, within striking distance. And there's kind of a small rivalry, The close-up magicians somewhat derisively refer to the stage magicians as box pushers or furniture movers, kind of saying, oh, they're relying on these complex apparatus, whereas sleight of hand is far more skillful. And I don't think that's necessarily true. And ultimately, I think they rely on very much the same kind of principles. But I personally am a big fan of the stuff that happens right in front of you. It's minimalistic. And there's something really charming about being able to fool by these simple analog props in a high-tech digital age. It's CGI and Pixar and whatnot. So that's kind of my jam, is the, sort of the card tricks and the coin tricks.
So your job is to make us think we're paying attention to the right thing when what you're doing is actually taking place somewhere else?
Well, that's basically right, although I think one of the big misperceptions of magic is that it's sort of like the spotted owl technique. It's like, hey, look over there, and then you do something here.
Right.
But actually, the curious thing about it is it's not really where you're looking, it's where you're focusing. And those two things aren't inherently coupled. You can be looking right at something and not see it if your attention is somewhere else. If you're thinking about, what you had for dinner, did you put the stove on? And there's lots of psychological experiments that show this, on so-called inattentional blindness, which is this notion that, if your attention wanders, things that are, in the zone of fixation, as they call it, right in the front of your eyes, will go unnoticed. That a famous gorilla video, I think a lot of people have probably seen that, where, people watch a video of people passing around, a basketball, and a gorilla walks across the screen and they don't even notice because they're too busy focusing on the ball. This has been confirmed time and again. The magicians use that. It's not just about where you're looking, it's about where you're focusing. And you can be looking right at the guy's hand. They did these British guys did an experiment where they had a magician vanish a cigarette by dropping it in their lap. It's called lapping in the parlance, in the patois of magic. And they found that using eye tracking tools, people who were staring right at the hand as it dropped the cigarette in their lap were no less likely to be fooled by the trick than those who weren't. So it wasn't so much where they're looking. And the gorilla video, same deal. They've used eye-tracking devices. The people who don't see the gorilla are looking right at it. It's not that it's not that the light from the image doesn't enter the eye. Somehow the brain fails to process it.
I was totally fooled by that the first time I saw it. And people who want to Google it can
too.
Go right now and get it. It'll embarrass you after you realize, but it's totally worth it if you...
Well, you're in good company, because pretty much, the majority of people fall for it. I actually saw a new version of it recently. I went to a lecture, and they showed it, and I was so disguised, I was totally dismissive. Oh, I've seen this thing. I know, it's a gorilla. But then afterwards, they showed it again, and it turns out that there were all these other things that changed, like the background changed colors, and one of the players left. Mm-hmm. It was specifically directed at the people who think they're smart and they think they've seen it. Hmm. And it made me think about how magicians operate. Magicians are always fooling each other, and they use they have these tournaments where they get together and they just try to put one over on each other.
Right.
And they do that very much in the same way. They'll show you a trick, and it's a trick that you think you've seen before, but then there'll be some twist. So you're paying attention to what you think is a secret, but then they do it another way, or they vary the method. And really, even the best magicians succumb because our expectations and our assumptions and these basic perceptual flaws that are ingrained
Gotta jump in. We have to take a quick break here. Alex Stone is my guest. His new book is called Fooling Houdini. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Alex Stone. He's written for publications including The Wall Street Journal, Harper's, The New York Times, and Discover Magazine. His new book is called Fooling Houdini, Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind. It's just come out in a paperback edition. If you want to join the conversation, we invite you to call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. So you mentioned before the break that, you know, there are various competitions around the world where magicians try to sort of fool each other. Very early in the book, you share an experience that you had in Stockholm at a sort of Olympics for the world's best magicians. You'd invited your parents to go. Everybody you cared about was there. Tell us a little bit about what happened.
Yeah, right. So there's every 3 years, there's a World Championships of Magic, and they're often referred to as the Magic Olympics. Mm-hmm. And they're very similar in a way. They're every 3 years, except not every 4 years. But the last one actually took place in England, like weeks before the regular non-magic Olympics last summer. And the one before that was in Beijing at the same Olympic Village. The one I went to was in Stockholm in 2006, and I'd never competed before, and I really had no idea what I was getting into. These are some of the best magicians in the world. Many of them have been working, you know, for 6, 7, 8 years on their routine, which is like, it's like figure skating. You perform a routine in front of a judges, like, and they give you points, you know. So I entered with this just totally amateurish routine that I thought was really good, but I ended up not doing so well. So there's this rule at the Magic Olympics that if you are so bad that within the first few minutes the judges deem you to be beneath the minimum skill level that any magician who enters ought to have, they light this red lamp of shame, and you're immediately required to get off stage. And so basically that happened to me, and it was, you know, I was basically in front of like 1,000 people, many of them children. So, yeah, that's what happened. And then after that, you know, I sort of didn't do magic for a while because it was, you know, I was so chastened.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, there's two ways you can go after an experience like that, right? You can, like, say, yeah, I'm getting back up on the horse, I'm going to do this thing. Or you say, my goodness, what was I thinking? I'm going to pretend that never happened and move on with my life and, you know, get my degree in physics.
Yeah, so I did a little bit of both. For a while, I kind of stayed out of it, and I was a little embarrassed. But then eventually I kind of got back into it because I always liked it. And I mean, ultimately, you know, I was like way over my head, and I was completely deluded about my abilities. I didn't realize what I was getting into, and you know, I kind of felt good about the fact that I tried, even though it was, you know, I totally got spanked. Then finally I started doing magic again, and I started to try to really learn it more from the ground up. You know, I went to a magic school, I got a sort of a mentor, I started to really try to understand not just the moves and the mechanics, although I did begin practicing a lot more, but I also tried to understand the history and the philosophy and the science and the psychology of it. And that's sort of the beginning of where Fooling Houdini starts, this story of, you know, me trying to learn and master magic, me exploring this world, and also trying to achieve some manner of redemption after this crushing defeat.
So what does it take, Alex, to find a mentor, to know it's the right fit, to sort of commit yourself to someone and have him commit himself to you? And I say him because they're mostly men, but of course there are women magicians out there.
Yeah. Well, there are schools of magic, for one. And in some countries, in the U.S. it's not quite so formal, but in some countries, like in China, I think they have state-sponsored schools, you know.
That's awesome.
There's a tradition there of, like, the circus and gymnastics and stuff like that. And in Spain, there's a Madrid school. It's a very famous institution. In the U.S., there's a couple. There's one in Vegas called the Magic and Mystery School, run by these guys, Jeff McBride and Eugene Berger, who are fairly well-respected, or very well-respected magicians. And they refer to this school as Hogwarts for Grown-Ups, which is pretty hilarious. And it's, you know, it's run out of their house. And I went and took a 3-day master class with them, which was very interesting and formative. And then I also found a mentor. And, you know, with magic, it's a lot of informal gatherings. In New York, where I live, there are these, you know, this tradition of magicians hanging out in the backs of dingy diners and pizzerias on Saturday afternoon. And this goes back decades, and they've been doing this since the 50s. And so I started hanging out at one of these pizzerias, and sort of the informal leader of this group was this older guy named Wes, and and he would sort of mentor people. And so I started to sort of sidle up to him and learn from him. And that, I guess he sort of became my mentor in a way.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We have Scott on the line in Dallas. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Alex. You know, I was just kind of flipping through the stations, and I, of course, KRA was always interesting. But I'm not a musician, but and it has nothing. Hey, buddy, it has nothing in perception. That's magic. I said that rabbit was there a minute ago, and now it's there. Don't give me that perception stuff. No, I'm just kidding.
Did you have a question,
but
Scott?
But anyway, my question is: have you seen The Illusionist? And do you think that David Blaine? He's like the top. That guy can do anything. What are your comments about those two things?
Well, The Illusionist is a great film. I really like that. And it's interesting because some of those tricks are loosely based on actual tricks that were done by Jean-Eugène Robert Houdin, which was this very famous French magician. And he's often regarded as the sort of grandfather of modern magic. He kind of really took it off, dressed it up, and made it into this form, these formal shows. And he was incredibly influential, and he wrote about these sort of psychological principles in a very intelligent and lucid way. So a couple of those tricks are literally based on stuff that he did. And just as a side note, that's where Houdini got his name, actually, from Robert Houdin.
H-O-U-D-I-N is how it's spelled in French.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It's spelled Houdin, yeah, exactly. And so he took the name and then later disavowed it, because Houdini was a sort of mercurial guy, and he was like, oh, now I hate it. Now I hate him. In terms of Blaine, you know, I don't know that he can do anything, but he is certainly a great magician, and I'm a big fan of sort of his early stuff. You know, when he went on the street, he did street magic, and he would do cards for people. Now he's doing these more, well, kind of Houdini-esque feats, and, you know, he's a magician, but he's done a lot to sort of reimagine magic, and he's really influential. He's really inspired a lot of people to get into it. By kind of making it fresh. I mean, like when he did those street magic specials, he was very clever. I think he hired one of the producers from Cops to give it this kind of very reality-ish kind of gritty feel. And also it was very clever because he focused on the reactions of the people who were watching it. And that's kind of what magic's all about. It's people freaking out. So I think that made it really cool. But you know, it's still magic. So, you know, got to take it all with a bit of a grain of salt.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Daniel in Dallas. Hi, Daniel.
Hello.
Hi.
So, Chris, is it fine if I ask two questions, one short one and one sort of long one?
This time only, absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. So, first, you know the show Chris Angel Mind Freak, correct? Mind
Freak, yeah.
Yes. Have you seen the episode where they're in a park and he pulls a woman in half and her disembodied torso crawls away?
Oh, the one where he cuts himself in half?
Well, he pulls a lady in half. He brings a lady in from some park and just pulls her in half.
Yeah, right.
So
do I know how that's done?
Yes.
Have you tried Googling it? Because I bet you could find out online.
That's a good idea. Rather than spoil it for people who might not want to know, we can do that. I think that's a good suggestion. And Daniel, did you have a second question?
Yes, ma'am. Okay, so my second question is, do you think like as technology progresses to where things like levitation and possibly disappearing aren't that like out of the ordinary, and magic will have to change to like adapt to, because people won't be as excited by things that they see almost every other day?
Huh.
Well, if we actually do someday invent teleportation and levitation, then yes, I think magic might have to figure out another trick. But, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I think it was Arthur C. Clarke who once said that any sufficiently advanced technology looks like magic. And certainly today, I mean, if I look at my iPhone and I'm just like, this is incredible. And it's kind of interesting that magic, that people even are still interested in magic, given how miraculous some of our technologies have become. And the more it advances, the more we realize that we're capable of. But I also think it's really kind of cool that people still like magic. And that, you know, a card trick or a coin trick, something very simple like that, a sleight of hand, is still still fascinating and can still bring a lot of joy in an age where technology has become so advanced that it does seem to border on the fantastical.
I absolutely loved reading about Richard Turner. Now, before you tell him his story and about him as a person, just tell us a little bit about the kinds of tricks that he works on and the skills that he has.
Yeah, well, Richard Turner is a card mechanic, which is, he specializes in cheating at cards, gambling sleights. Mm-hmm. He's not actually a cheat. He doesn't actually do anything illegal, but he's probably the world's best, or certainly one of the best experts when it comes to the sleight of hand techniques that you would use to cheat at, say, poker. You know, and that includes things like false shuffles, dealing from the bottom of the deck or the middle of the deck, you know, beating the cut, stacking the deck. And there's sleights that conform to the protocols of you know, card table, card games that you would play at like a casino. And the amazing thing about Turner is he's got, you know, he can do absolutely incredible things with cards. Like, you can tell him exactly any number of cards and can just reach over and cut off that many cards. He can do two decks at once. He can do perfect shuffles with one hand. His fake deals are literally the best I've ever seen. And he's blind. Hmm. The crazy thing about it is he's completely blind, and he does it all by touch, by feel. And he's sort of developed this very, very sensitive sense of touch and tactile ability that allows him to manipulate the cards and to sense, to feel the cards with incredible precision. He's so good that the U.S. Playing Card Company, the world's largest manufacturer of cards, has hired him as their touch analyst, which means they send him decks of cards, and he essentially does quality control. He feels that he can tell if the paper is a little thicker than, you know, or the cards are cut, you know, with the dull blade or whatnot. A remarkable guy. He lives in Texas, too, by the way, San Antonio, which is where I grew up.
Yeah, well, what's astonishing is that he can tell the weight of things, and you mentioned, you know, he can tell if there was a dull blade used. And mm-hmm. you, in working with him, got curious about his abilities and what they say about the way the brain wires itself.
Yeah, right. So, you know, one of the biggest discoveries in neuroscience of recent years is this idea that the brain actually changes in adulthood. It used to be thought that, you know, the brain was like our bones, basically, that after a certain age, essentially after adolescence, it was locked in, and the brain couldn't really change after that. And now we realize that the brain can adapt in remarkable ways, and the so-called neuroplasticity has become one of the dominant themes of modern neuroscience. I think, you know, we've always heard this idea, you know, that when you lose one sense, the other senses, you know, compensate. And that's certainly true. Now they've done research on blind subjects, blind people, for instance, and they've found that their sense of touch tends to be far more developed, and their sense of hearing is a lot more accurate. And, you know, perfect pitch among blind musicians is far higher than among non-blind musicians. And I think Turner is an example of this, you know, and he's lost his sense of sight, and his sense of touch has become so much more refined. He's able to do these incredible feats.
It was remarkable to me to read that he says he truly believes that when it comes to doing his magic, his blindness is an advantage.
Absolutely. I once asked him, you know, how do you view your blindness? You know, do you feel like it's a disadvantage or what? And he said it's a gift. He views it as a gift. And he almost feels sorry for people who don't have that. He says, you know, because I have to do it all by touch. It's really why, you know, I think he views it as why he's so good. And another really interesting thing about him is the way he talks about touch in visual terms. Like, he talks about how when he types on his BlackBerry or whatever, he sees the letters in his mind. And when he feels the cards, he sees them as these bricks, almost, these large objects. And that has this very interesting corollary in neuroscience, because fairly recently they started to look at, you know, the brains of blind people when they execute, say, tactile tasks, like reading Braille or touching some grating or whatever. And they used functional MRI to see what parts of the brain were active, and they found that the visual cortex, the part of the brain that controls vision, the part of the brain that lights up when a person with sight, you know, looks at a, you know, watches a movie or a baseball game or whatever. And that's striking because it suggests that somehow they're seeing with their fingers, that the part of the brain that controls vision has somehow been retasked to control and process tactile sensations. And this is a form of plasticity that really wasn't believed to be possible. It's known as cross-modal plasticity. It's one brain region taking over for another. And And that's something that we really wasn't believed to be possible because, well, for one, the stimuli, the information from each sense travels to the brain along distinct pathways. So this is really kind of really cool, I think. You know, the brain is really full of tricks.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Jeff on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Chris. Hey, Alex. Thoroughly enjoying the presentation, and believe me, I'll be one of those going on buying your book today. But I was very curious. You know, it sounds like it, and it reminds me a lot of what I'm seeing on National Geographic, the show Brain Games, that has been on now for a little bit. And Apollo.
Sure,
Rocky,
I love that show. Yeah.
Edition. Oh my gosh, it's excellent. And I, much like you, grew up, I'm probably quite a bit older than you, but grew up in the days of primetime special magicians. And in fact, one thing that was cool for me is my first cousin was Doug Henning's attorney, as well as the attorney from Magic Castle out in California. So I was baptized by fire early on for me within this realm. But for the last 26 years, I've been in the fields of criminal profiling and threat assessment, and I've advocated on many occasions that much the same way the magicians and mentalists use misdirection, illusion, accomplices, this is the way that criminals and con artists use the same to achieve their goals.
What do you think about that, Alex?
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, and I certainly think that makes a lot of sense. You know, as part of researching my book, I spent some time looking at cons. Specifically, I was interested in the three-card Monty because that's really essentially a magic trick and a form of sleight of hand. And I spent a lot of time kind of casing some of these Monty guys that in New York hang out on Canal Street and what struck me is just, well, first of all, much like you say, they use, you know, these cons really do rely on the same principles of misdirection and baiting and manipulating expectations that magicians use, and that they still work and that people lose a lot of money. That kind of blows my mind. And it occurred to me, I'm certainly not the first person to think this, that, you know, lots of different cons and scams and crimes are in many ways an application of the techniques of magic and the similar type of psychological manipulation. And it makes sense, too, because magic is a kind of deception for entertainment. But, you know, these techniques of deception can be used to fool people, to defraud them, to steal from them and whatnot. I think that's... And there is this dark side to magic because there are certainly people...
Let me jump in really quick. We'll take another quick break. Alex Stone is my guest. His new book is called Fooling Houdini. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with writer Alex Stone, author of the book Fooling Houdini, Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind. It's out now in paperback. If you want to be part of the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Alex, you were talking about three-card Monty, which is like the oldest game in the world, and it still takes a lot of money from a lot of people.
Yeah.
And part of the reason I love your exploration of this, part of the reason it still works is that the person who gets duped always is led to believe that they have figured the trick out and that they have the upper hand.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, I think one of the things that is amazing about the game is that you know, people tend to think that it works because the sucker doesn't know that it's a con, but the fact is that it depends on the person thinking that it's a con and then thinking that they can write themselves into it, you know? And so the way it works is, you know, they'll have all these shills, these accomplices, and, you know, one of the shills will pretend to win, and another shill will pretend to lose in a kind of obvious way, and then another shill will pretend to cheat, and then another one will try to cheat, but the operator, the guy who's tossing the cards, will catch him and then switch the cards while he's not looking. And the sucker, the mark, who's watching this the whole time, thinks, oh my goodness, this game is totally a scam, it's totally crooked, and I can write myself into it. He thinks he can scam the scammers. And that's really the trick. It's not convincing him that somehow this is a legitimate game, because no one really thinks it's a legitimate game. It's convincing him that it's a scam he can beat.
We have an email here from Danny in Dallas who says, I just returned from TAM, the amazing meeting, where a panel became quite explosive regarding not telling an audience that such acts as mentalists, psychics, and magicians were not real, promoted magical thinking. Do you support not discouraging such beliefs?
Do I support not discouraging people believing in magical, actual magic?
It's a little bit confusing, but why don't you answer that, and we'll get an answer,
right?
Essentially,
if I understand, so the amazing meeting is a skeptics meeting. It's the amazing Randy is a famous skeptic and also a magician, and he's very much of the view that magicians are, it behooves magicians, or they're really, it's kind of their responsibility to disabuse people of false belief systems that can be encouraged by magicians if they don't, you know, disavow magical powers. And I totally think that that's right. I think it's very important that magicians not cross that line and convince people that they can actually read minds or do magic. It's less important in magic, like you were saying earlier, you know, David Copperfield, no one really believes it. But magicians who do, say, mentalism tricks, like bending silverware or reading minds or predicting things, people often believe that that's real, and it's not. It's a series of tricks, and it's basically a form of magic, and I think it's really important that we do reveal how that's done so people don't think that, you know, that these powers actually exist.
So you caught some flack a few years ago for an article that you wrote that revealed some secrets of magic, but you don't think it necessarily even hurts our experience of a trick to know some of how it's done.
Yeah, I actually think it doesn't hurt it at all. In fact, I think it betters it. I think this magician's code, you know, that you should never reveal a secret, is a little silly. I mean, I get where it comes from. You know, there's this idea that if you don't, you know, that if you know the secret, it's ruined. And that may be true for some tricks, which are not, you know, which rely on silly gimmicks and whatnot, but I don't think it's true for most tricks. And I also think that the techniques of magic are often as interesting as, you know, the tricks themselves, because there's a lot of skill behind it and there's a lot of interesting psychology behind it. So I think it deepens people's appreciations and makes them like it more. So I think it's actually kind of fun to reveal the secrets and good for the art.
Yeah, and just because I know I've been told how to do something does not mean I could pull it off.
Well, that's true. I mean, certainly there's, and not only that, I mean, there's many, many examples of, you know, you can tell a person how a trick is done and then show it the same trick to them the next day and they'll still be fooled by it. Or show them a very similar trick that's, you know, uses the same principles to do something else. We're really easy to fool because our brains are wired that way. And so I think that, and I think by letting people in, you know, one of the things that's tough about magic is that it's like, I know the secret and you don't, ha-ha. You know, and it kind of sets up an adversarial relationship. And so I think, you know, being a little bit more open sort of soothes the sting of that.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have David on the line in Plano. Hello, David.
Oh, hi. Another great show as always. I have two questions real quick. One was, I was going to ask your guest comments to comment on Penn and Teller and their brand of magicianship, especially when you go into the paid shows that they do, where they get to be more freely spoken about their political views and how that kind of works into the magic act. It's actually kind of amusing. But the other thing, too, I was going to ask you is if your guest had seen the movie The Prestige, which talks about or deals with two fiercely competitive musicians and how they each try to outdo one another and almost sabotage each other's tricks now and again. And it was just a fascinating movie about the, I guess, the early days. And I was kind of curious to know if there was such a kind of rivalry back when, and at turn of the century, the 20th century, when the movie's basically kind of set in.
Well, let's see if we can get an answer for you. Thanks, David.
Yeah, great question. I love Penn and Teller. I think they've done a lot to elevate magic. In reference to what I was talking about earlier, they sometimes reveal secrets and then, you know, show you another trick that's similar and fool you with it. So I think that's very smart. And I think I like their sort of political side of their, you know, and they're very much about, you know, being skeptical too. In terms of rivalries, absolutely, yes. The magicians back then had crazy rivalries. And a lot of times, for instance, you know, one magician would publish the secrets to a rival magician's trick or steal their secrets. I mean, they had like spies that would, you know, infiltrate another magician's retinue and then use their techniques. And magicians would try to sue each other. And it was crazy. I mean, there were really, really strong and bitter rivalries between magicians, and that's not so true anymore so much. But back then, in the so-called sort of golden age of magic, there were lots of famous rivalries.
How did you measure your progress in the time that you devoted to really improving your craft as a magician?
It's hard to measure exactly because it's not like chess where there's rankings, you know. But you certainly can measure it in for one, just being able to master certain moves, you know. It's like learning an instrument, like learning piano. Oh, this is an etude that's really hard, and I just learned how to do it. And there are things that are like scales in a way, you know, techniques that you can practice over and over again.
And excuse me for interrupting, you actually exercised your fingers so that they would be more deft.
Right. I even did this thing called finger fitness, which was developed by a guy out in Ohio, a former musician, actually, who developed this kind of regimen of finger gymnastics that allows you to increase the strength of your hands and their flexibility and dexterity. And so I did do that, and I learned about it from magicians. Specifically from these magicians who do what's known as extreme card manipulation, which is like, it really is almost juggling with cards. It's these very, very difficult and dexterous flourishes and cuts and moves with cards. Google it. It's really cool. But so I did that. And then, you just learn more and more difficult tricks. And you also measure it in terms of the reactions that you get. You learn, you know, or how you succeed, or how often you get caught when you do a palm, or how often you're able to trick someone into picking the right card. And so a lot of it is just practicing in front of people and seeing how they react and seeing what you can get away with and seeing how much they enjoy the tricks, you know, because it is ultimately a form of entertainment.
How much of the performance is about your demeanor, the things you say or don't say, the look on your face, as opposed to what your hands are doing?
Well, it's huge, I think. It's really a big deal. The techniques are kind of like the notes or in the concerto, but the music is beyond that. It's more about the presentation and also the psychological side of it, what you say, how you interact with the person, how you interact with the audience, and then also just your persona, like how likable you are, it's a form of theater. So there's all these presentational aspects to what is your character, are you funny? Are you mysterious? And what are you actually trying to say? You know, are you trying to tell a story? Because in a way, magic tricks, the best of them at least, kind of tell a story. Even if it's, they're symbolic, they're grounded in these sort of metaphorical, very kind of primitive metaphorical tales or, almost like a kind of waking form of dreams.
So you mentioned the rivalry, friendly, I suppose, between the big stage magicians and the folks who do close-up work. What about within those realms? I mean, do you respect pretty much anybody who's good at what he does? Or are there some people whose, like, their patter bothers you or you think they're, like, a little overly dramatic? How do you assess how good somebody is?
Well, I mean, magic is, a lot of magic is really cheesy. I mean, go ahead and say that. I think we can all agree that, it's inherently cheesy. And I say that as someone who really likes to do magic. Mm-hmm. And so as a fan of magic, it is cheesy still. And that's okay because, a lot of stuff is cheesy and still great. But it's tough to do magic in a way that's not cheesy because it's a form of like fantasy almost. It's in the sort of, it's not too far off from like people who do like, dress up in Civil War costumes or do creative anachronism or play D&D. So like
you want it to be true. Is that the reason?
Yeah, I mean, it's a form of make-believe, in a way. And it's also a form of kind of very old theater. Like magic was huge back in the day before there were movies and comedy, I guess there was comedy, but before there was movies and radio and television.
Yeah.
And entertainment has gotten very sophisticated. So, and also I think honestly, the fact that magic is so much about keeping its secrets has held it back because magicians end up relying on old tricks and not innovating. That's why I think, magicians like Penn and Teller are so great because they really have innovated and they really have invented new stuff and they're constantly refreshing their act. But it's hard. And there are a lot of magicians that I think fall into the trap of being old fashioned or stuck in the 80s with, pirate shirts and tight pleather pants and whatnot. But then again, then you have people who are updating it and doing new things. And so I think it's, but I, so there are certainly you know, a lot of people who I don't, you know, I think that they could probably, you know, use an MTV makeover. But there's a lot of new interesting stuff. A lot of it's stuff you don't see. A lot of it, especially in the close-up sleight of hand realm, is stuff that's going on. Kind of, they call it underground magic, and it's not popularly known. But it's really, some of that stuff is just brilliant. There are kids out there, you know, teenagers who are inventing new tricks. They're really pushing the envelope. And that stuff is, you know, you're not going to see it so much on television, but it's quite astounding.
Where do you go when you want to see what people are innovating and doing that might not be in a big sort of, you know, $100 a ticket stage show?
Yeah, exactly. I'd say two places. One is magic conferences and the conventions. And the best stuff, I mean, literally the most amazing magical experiences I've ever had would be at like a magic conference at 1 a.m. when, say, Juan Tamariz, who's this very famous Spanish magician and probably the greatest living card magician, probably the greatest living magician if I would have to pick one. And he'll just at 1 o'clock he'll say, "Hey, everyone gather around," and he'll, you know, he'll stand at a table and a bunch of people, all magicians will gather around and he'll pull out a deck of cards or borrow a deck of cards and perform for an hour and just completely destroy everyone, and it's just people will scream and cry and laugh, and it's just, and that's the kind of thing that I think is you know, you can't really replicate that. And then also I would say just go to a magic store or a pizzeria or the back of a diner on a Saturday afternoon, and you'll just see people do stuff casually, and it'll just totally blow your mind and amaze you.
How easy is it, or how possible is it to make your living doing magic, even if you've worked for hours and hours and years and years?
It's really hard. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like trying to be a juggler or, I don't know, a clown or, you know, some of the best magicians in the world work on cruise ships, you know, and do kids shows, you know, to make money. Not everyone. I mean, don't get me wrong. A lot of magicians make really good livings doing corporate gigs and things like that, you know. But it's tough. It's tough in the way that, you know, being a musician is tough, I think. Although there are a lot more venues for magicians than there are for magicians these days, right? I mean, when's the last time you went to go see a magic show, you know, as opposed to, like, go see a movie or maybe even stand-up comedy or music?
Yeah.
So there's just not the venue for it that there was 100 years ago. It's not a dominant form, I'd say, of cultural. It's not a sort of iconic cultural medium the way it was at one time. So it's tough. And that's why some of the best magicians now and also, you know, for traditionally have been amateurs. Or not amateurs, but, you know,
hobbyists, I mean, or part-timers?
Like intense hobbyists or people who had jobs, who have other jobs. You know, like Edward Marlowe, the great Chicago card genius, was a machinist, you know. You know, a lot of these people have made their living in other ways, but they've been truly influential. And you know, so it's not always, about, you know, a career. Sometimes it's just about a passion.
Alex Stone's book is called Fooling Houdini, Magicians, Mentalists, Math Geeks, and the Hidden Powers of the Mind. It's now available in paperback. Alex, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had help from Christina Martinez on the phones, and our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Jeff Whittington is Think's executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think, and send any comments, questions, or suggestions via email to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.